So, Giacetta, how did you come to be part of the peace movement in the beginning?
I think I fell into it a bit by accident, like most things that happen. You know, I was quite young when I went. I was only about 18, but I think my dad was quite a strong sort of black working class union kind of person, so I kind of did have a bit of a political upbringing and lived in the inner city, Southampton. And basically, I had a boyfriend, my first boyfriend, his mum used to go to Greenham, and there was quite a lot of, you know, Southampton women that went to Greenham Common, because it was just half an hour up the A34 to get to Newbury, where the campus was. So she, ironically, she gave me a lift to Greenham, because I promptly fell madly in love with a woman at Greenham Common as soon as I arrived.
And when did you arrive? What year?
So that was in 1988. That was the summer of 88. Yeah. So yeah, I was still 18 at that point. Yeah. And just went, you know, with my mum's old kind of canvas rucksack for a couple of nights, and just not only fell in love with this woman, but fell in love with the whole thing. I didn't really know anything much about it before. I just had heard of it. Mm. But, you know, was into sort of the idea of pacifism and CND as much as I could be at that age. Yeah, so just spending a couple of nights there really inspired me, and I basically then went back to Southampton for a couple of nights, kind of broke up with my boyfriend over the next few weeks, and just kept going back to Greenham and staying longer and longer, and really I was pretty much living there for the next 2 years.
Right, wow, okay. And what gate were you at?
So I started off at Orange Gate, because that's where all the Southampton women tended to go.
Right.
So my first year I was mostly at Orange Gate, and then my second year I kind of moved to Blue Gate, where for some reason, I don't know, there were lots of vegans and lots of Librans at Blue Gate.
Yeah.
So I kind of fitted in. All the gates had slightly different atmospheres, so it was quite interesting, slightly different women.
Yeah, what did you make of, I mean, what was your experience of that, the gates having different characters?
It's funny, so I think, yeah, Orange Gate, there was lots of women from Southampton, but all different ages, maybe slightly older women, a few international women. I mean, there were international women at all the gates visiting and living there. And then Green Gate, to me, always had this kind of more mystical, hippie, kind of slightly odd atmosphere. Not odd bad, but just, you know, I was a little intimidated. Yeah. and it was because that was very beautiful. It was set more away from the road, whereas Orange Gate, you know, it was near a lane from one of the main roads.
Right.
You know, and obviously we camped more in the woods, but, you know, Green Gate felt like it was much more set back in the woods. And then there was Woad Gate, which for some reason there were just a couple of straight women that lived there. So that was kind of like the straight gate. and that was really not a nice gate to stay at, purely because it was literally just the perimeter road and no kind of woodlands. It was just the road and a gate. So you were always sat with your fire right by the road and the gate. It wasn't particularly beautiful. And then just along from there was Blue Gate, which I loved, because whilst it was kind of clear to the road, near... whilst it was near the road, so you still had the vigies, the vigilantes, the locals would shout out their car windows, which we just thought was hilarious, really.
What did they shout? Do you remember?
Dirty leathers, get a job. Just all kinds of homophobic abuse, and just that, you know, I think some of it was just bored youngsters. That's something that they could get away with doing. They clearly didn't know or understand really what we were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, the era that I was there, sort of 86, 88, there wasn't anything too serious that happened. I know earlier years, there was some violence. I'm trying to think, while I was there, I think there was the occasional kind of someone's stuff would get, you know, a tent would get ripped, and, you know, because some of the vigilantes would, you know, do more kind of damaging things.
Do you remember how many people were there around that time?
Well, it was quite busy. The first year I was there, there was still quite a lot of women. So, you know, each gate, I mean, Woad Gate was always really little, because probably no one really wanted to camp that close to the road. It wasn't that nice. So there was only two or three there. But at Orange Gate, when I was there, there was a good sort of, especially in the summer, there'd be 10 to 20 maybe,
right.
Blue Gate probably 10 or 15 maybe. Wow. In the winter it would dwindle because, you know, you'd be dealing with frozen water, frozen toothpaste. So it was a lot
harsher.
Did you
stay there?
I stayed there the whole winter, yeah. I mean, like lots of people, I think I always, you know, you'd go home in the days when you could sign on really easily, you know, you'd go and sign on, get showers, go home for a couple of days here and there. But
I was going to ask you, did you have to make any sacrifices to go? Well, like with work and stuff like that, or presumably you were signing on?
Personally not, because I just scraped through a couple of A-levels and finished... because that was the summer that I would have just finished sixth form. So I was going to go to a technical college and do some more. I was going to do like politics and philosophy A-levels. And I basically gave those up because I very consciously decided I'd rather live it than study it anymore.
Right.
So for me, it was perfect timing. It's what I call my finishing school, my Greenham years, two years.
Yeah, you know. A lot of women do actually, yeah.
You know, because it was my political awakening. That's where I learnt stuff. I learnt a lot. And I wasn't working anything formally.
Yeah.
I didn't have kids. I was just 18. I don't feel like I gave up that much.
And how were your parents? I mean, obviously you said your father was fairly political anyway. Did your parents respond okay to you?
Well, I'd actually run away from home on my 17th birthday. So I didn't, I was quite estranged, mostly from my dad. So I didn't really have a lot of interaction with him about it. I know that because it was close to Southampton, that there was an image of me on the news where the local press, the local news were reporting about something at Greenham.
Right.
And that's how, like, you know, the Jamaicans of Southampton found out that I was there. I don't know if I'd even really told my dad. He may or may not have known. But, you know, especially back then, Jamaican culture is very, very conservative. So it was it was quite scandalous. Like being a Rasta, my cousin next door was a Rasta. That was a scandal in our community. So me going to Greenham, which in lots of places is shorthand for also being a lesbian.
Yeah.
That was all quite controversial.
So you never officially came out to your family?
I did to my dad. And he was just a little bit slightly offensive and slightly dismissive about it.
Right.
in the kind of patriarchal, women can't really do anything, and which one the man? He always used to say, which one the man? That's
right.
Even if I, you know, because I was estranged, I didn't see him for a while, but when I'd pop back and visit him later with friends, he'd always be, oh, which one's the man? And he'd just say that to both of us, which would be, we just thought it was funny at the time, luckily, but it was also... You know, there we go. It was the 80s. My mum was always much more supportive. And even though, you know, she helped me run away from home. So we stayed more in contact. But while she was still living with him, I didn't see her much until she left as well. And then, you know, she'd come and visit Greenham for the day and was really interested. She was always really interested. Absolutely fine about my sexuality. Nothing ever bothered. Nothing ever surprised her. She knew that I was scared because after leaving home in those circumstances, I was, you know, I'd had this like, you know, managed to then have a nice friendship with my mum, and I was scared to tell her that I was a lesbian.
Yeah.
And got my sister to. And my sister said that my mum said she already knew, and I think that's often the case. They know anyway.
Yeah. And so could you tell us more about the sort of, was it primarily that was your first love affair with a woman?
Yes.
Yes.
Although,
so...
yes, unfortunately wasn't a love affair with her. Managed a drunken roll around at a party that we'd hitched to. There was lots of partying at Greenham, especially at Orange Gate, because we were kind of a bit of a party gate. And I think that some of the other gates, so you were asking about, you know, I never stayed at Yellow Gate, but I know there was a little bit of a schism between Yellow Gate and some of the other gates that I didn't really fully understand or appreciate being young and into partying as well as into the politics. We were more of a party gate, and, you know, there'd be booze runs most nights, and, you know, we mixed up.
So were you in a relationship with someone there or not?
No,
or just
no.
Wishing you were?
No, I just wished I was. I was in love with her for years.
Gosh.
I mean, we actually became good friends for many years.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting what pulls you to a place, though, and then you get treasure in a different way. I guess.
I mean, it wasn't her that pulled me there. It was just it was the whole thing of it.
You're right.
You know, like it took a, you know, it probably took a while for me to, but with her anyway, yes, we had the kind of drunken roll around a party one night that we'd hitched to and some big squat in Nottingham. She didn't even know I'd never been with a woman before. She didn't realise. She said years later that she would have stayed sober for the event if she'd known. But we did become friends. We're still vaguely in touch, like with Facebook. We found each other and we both were in London for a while. So we did meet up and she's, you know, married to a woman and we've all had dinner and stuff together. Mm. Which is kind of funny when, you know, you lived at Greenham 20, 30 years ago. But there were lots of relationships going on there, of course. Lots of queer drama, lots of various polyamorous and monogamous things in the dramas.
And was that a kind of a strain to live around in terms of you all living together and you're all kind of in each other's relationships, in a sense? You're observing the tensions and the good bits and the bad bits, all that kind of stuff. Did you find that difficult? Or
not particularly, no. I mean, obviously there were times when there was awkwardness and times where certain women might need to like leave or go to a different gate, but that was such a small part of it. I think, you know, because mostly, you know, one of the things I learned about Greenham, I was thinking about it this morning, was you know, things like small and massive things like communication and how you have relationships. And the whole idea of Greenham is that, you know, it was non-hierarchical and we didn't have the language that we now have. But if you think about non-violent communication, I feel like that's what I was learning at Greenham. And that was the kind of spirit of Greenham, was that you wouldn't have like massive arguments. People would try and work stuff out and negotiate and, you know, have loving, non-violent, peaceful communications with each other. There was, you know, the personal as political was such a theme of Greenham, which is why we were there in the first place, actually, is that we were making personal sacrifices and decisions to be somewhere because that was our politics. And then actually how you interact in your intimate and friendship relationships is also part of your political.
So how did you, that sort of non-hierarchical thing, how did you, were there any incidences you remember where you overcame challenges or problems on the camp in that way? What were the sort of strategies you used?
Well, we had weekly meetings that went on for hours. So there was always meetings, and just, yeah, women talked. I mean, we, you know, there wasn't internet, there wasn't television. You know, what you did was sit around and make food together and chop wood together and dig shit pits together and go on actions together and you talk about stuff. Mm. So I think that, you know, that meant that we talked about things and resolved things.
Did you have like jobs there? Did you have your own sort of, was it all just...
Yeah, there were things that people liked to do. So I really loved wooding. So I'd quite happily go off into the woods and go and find dead bits of wood, bring it back, saw it, chop it up, you know, make sure there was wood for the fire. So people naturally did like different things. There'd be booze runs and there'd be shopping runs. And some of us, so I could drive. So people that could drive were then the ones that would obviously drive. They were sort of communal camp vehicles. Mm. We had Brown Van. Love Brown Van. It was just like part of the family. Brown Van was this old brown VW van that was like the camp van at Orange Gate. So, you know, lots of women lived in tents or what we call getaways, which were little red sort of tent structures that were really easy to pick up and move if and when the bailiffs came. But then there was also Brown Van, which some people would sleep in sometimes, but obviously just useful to have camp vehicles. So those of us who had mechanical skills or could drive then took more responsibility for vehicles and driving. You know, we pretty much took it in turns. I can't remember how it was organised. There wasn't a written rota, but we definitely kind of shared out and took it in turns. Things like, you know, cooking and doing dishes. But people just stepped up to it. I don't remember it being much of an issue. For sure there were times, you know, this is going back 32 years, for sure there were times where there was just lots of dirty mugs and people were annoyed.
Yeah.
But I don't totally remember that.
Yeah.
I also really liked, anything physical I liked, so digging shit pits I really enjoyed. You know, again, you just go off into the gorse and dig a load of, you know, dig a big trench.
And were you a vegan then?
I was vegetarian when I arrived and then I went vegan because I just celebrated my 30th vegan birthday. I'm one of the only or very few vegans from Greenham days that are still vegan that I know of. I mean, that's just based on the people that I'm still in touch with. So hopefully there's loads more. So I went vegan in my second, after being there for a year. Once I'd heard and learned about the cruelty to animals in the dairy industry, I then went vegan overnight really easily.
Mm.
People were shocked because I was, prior to that, really into cheese and chocolate.
Mm.
But it was just really easy as soon as I knew what they did to animals. I think I've always just been quite sensitive about politics and animals and ethics and all of that stuff. So yeah.
And so what kind of food were you eating there? Were you sort of experimental with it, or?
There was always loads of nice food. We used to toast bread. We had these sort of metal grills that you put slap a bit of bread on it and hold it over the fire, and that would, you know, you'd become expert at how to get the perfect toasting fire, not too flamey, like hot sort of embers were pretty good. So lots of toast with various spreads. So I discovered tahini and yeast extract that wasn't Marmite. So I learned lots of things. and then there were food runs as well. So especially in the winter, I think it was mostly in the winter months, lots of different peace groups and women's groups around the sort of nearby, so sort of the south of England, would, on a bit of a rota, bring us hot meals in the evening, which in the winter months when it's dark and cold was a lifesaver, because they'd be, I mean, it was a long time. In fact, I still don't really eat many baked potatoes and stews, because
there was so many.
There was just like 2 years of every night baked potato and stews, because that was easy to transport. But some women, I mean, I remember Abingdon women's groups were used to bring the most amazing food, like, you know, lovely pies and puddings. And we would always be really exciting on the Abingdon women's night. but yeah, you know, lots of salads. And we were a few miles from Newbury, the nearest town, but occasionally we'd go in and there was maybe one cafe that would serve us and a pub that would let us in Thatcham, and maybe one pub in Newbury. Lots of places didn't like Green and Women and wouldn't let us in. They just said that, you know, because we were considered to be smelly, dirty lesbians. Mm. So, you know, you'd go in shops and they would literally spray air freshener at you. And probably we did smell, but we'd smell of wood smoke more than anything.
Yes,
because we did, you know, I had a wash in the woods every day. I'm very fastidious about hygiene.
How did you do that? You just
take a bowl and just go and wash in the woods. And also the lovely Quakers let us use their meeting house in Newbury, which was amazing. So we could have showers and do laundry there. And then there was one cafe that we could go and get our, you know, in the days when I ate egg and chips, or just chips, like there was a cafe that would serve us. But really lots of shops wouldn't, food shops you can go and buy food shopping, but lots of shops and, you know, the health shop was fine.
How did that feel to be, have that sense of negativity?
Mostly, especially as a kind of teenager, mostly we had a bit of a fuck you, excuse my language, attitude to it, I think. I think we were just like, we knew that we were in the right and that they hadn't caught up, and that we were like, ultimately, we were there to save the planet. And I think we were all really fired up by that. That, you know, yes, we had booze runs and had lots of fun and all the rest of it happened, but actually we were there to save the planet, which, you know, in that era, in the 80s, it was still very much a time when people were worried about nuclear disasters. Yeah. And I don't think people can appreciate that maybe now, that that's the kind of, I guess now, you know, the comparison obviously is the climate change and the planet on the verge of extinction. And back then it was nuclear, you know, it was the days of Cold War.
Were you terrified of?
I wouldn't say I was terrified, but I was very keen to protest about nuclear arms, and I felt very strongly that we needed to get rid of nuclear arms.
Did you feel the threat of that was imminent, or did you feel it was an option, a possibility?
I felt like it was a strong possibility, I would say, and that it was something that we needed to stop, and politically it was something that we needed to raise awareness of, because, of course, the whole thing about Greenham was flying in the face of the Ministry of Defence's idea that they could just, there was lots of funny, there's lots of things like their idea that they could just hide missiles and hide military manoeuvres and hide the fact that there was this massive, massive, massive American military base in the middle of the beautiful countryside that they destroyed. I don't know how, I mean, it was a 9-mile perimeter fence, so that area of natural common land was destroyed by the base, and that they could fly in nuclear missiles and take these missiles on exercises down to Salisbury Plain, And in some of their blurb, it was that, you know, no one would notice, it would be a safe thing to do. And so part of our protest was that when they were exercising these vehicles, they'd manoeuvre them at night time from Newbury, from, you know, from Greenham Common down to Salisbury Plain, and we would, that's when we do lots of actions. So that's when we would have fires and singing and lots of women, and we'd throw what we call gloop, which was like flour and water with food colouring, so that there was something we could splatter on the side of the vehicles that would make them visible, not camouflaged.
Right, right.
So that was a lot of the work that we were doing, actually, was those kind of protests. And it was kind of flying in the face of the Ministry of Defence saying that, you know, no one would be bothered by this, that it was safe and secret, so no one would see the vehicles going there. And so we, you know, we were protesting that. And we'd sometimes go down to Salisbury Plain and also try and do actions on Salisbury Plain. But that was a little, that was a bit dangerous. That was the scariest I think I'd ever done, because on Salisbury Plain you also have American squaddies with their weapons, and there was a massive drug problem in the base, as there is in the military anyway, but that's not widely talked about in the media. But I remember coming across a squaddie with very bloodshot eyes and a loaded gun, you know, well, a gun which I presume is loaded, who knows, on Salisbury Plain in the middle of the night, because obviously lots of, you know, they would exercise vehicles and do manoeuvres in the night, so we would do actions in the night. I mean, and that's why part of the protest was always about singing, because women singing, it makes it obvious that we're women and that we are the Greenham women, which they were used to, because we just, you know, had been doing this for years, since 81. So by 86, they were very used to and bored off, for sure, Greenham women. So yeah, so the singing was really important, actually, to identify yourself as a woman.
Did you experience any kind of violence from those people?
I personally didn't, but I know other women did.
Right. Did you witness any of that?
I didn't witness anything, and I think I went towards the end of Greenham being quite busy in terms of lots of women, lots of peace women, in the early days, so in 81 and the first few years, I think there were thousands more women who would go and do actions, and there was a lot more, I think in the early days, a lot more violence and hostility.
Yeah.
So I didn't witness anything.
So did you feel that the relationship between the sort of male figures of authority and the Greenham women had changed then?
Probably. I mean, I can't compare it to something that I didn't experience.
No, of course, yeah.
But I think it was less violent, but there was still hostility. It was still like a bit of an us and them thing. Like, we were a pain in the ass, for sure. We did lots of damage. We did lots of disruption.
Do you remember what you did personally in terms of damage and disruption?
I don't want to incriminate myself.
No, okay, fair enough. I can cut that out.
But, you know...
Were you ever arrested?
I was arrested numerous times.
Were you, right?
So I was arrested within my couple... First, so, you know, I barely even knew what you were supposed to do if you're arrested. I was arrested within a couple of days of ever going there. And for sure, as one of the very few people of colour, I was the first person to be arrested in a whole group of people doing the exact same thing. And that was, again, on a night when they were exercising, taking out the military vehicles from Greenham and to take them down to Newbury. And we'd built fires, and there was fire engines and a fire hose. And I just remember that I'd picked up a fire hose and then got arrested for that, for holding a fire hose, because it was I got arrested for obstruction. And then put in a prison van thing for hours. So many hours that when it got to court, they didn't put me in prison, because the judge said, or the magistrate said, that I'd already been in the confined space for, you know, like, it was hours and hours and hours, because I was the first to be arrested and it went on all night. So they were arresting
people.
Can
you tell us about that experience then?
So that was, I mean, you know, again, I was really young, I was 18, but you just keep your spirits up. And as soon as someone else had been arrested and was in the same van, it made it a bit easier. And then more and more of us. So these prison vans are like basically vans with lots of tiny, tiny cubicles. I think there may or may not have been a little seat in there, but you're basically enclosed in a tiny box. So it's quite claustrophobic. And I didn't really know what was going on, how long I'd be there, what would happen to me.
Do you have enough air and that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. I had air, but there was no, again,
no windows.
It was like being in a box. So no windows, no phone for entertainment, no book, no nothing. It was just nothing for hours. But as soon as other women came in, then we could talk and we would sing. And that was always the things that we would sing. We learnt songs and we'd sing and entertain each other and make the best of it. So yeah, that was probably, I been at Greenham days. Definitely not even weeks, it was like within days of being there.
But were you afraid? I mean, I imagine that would be quite a scary experience being...
A little. You know, there's something about being a teenager where you just... Yes, you're scared, but you take things in your stride because it's all new and it's all exciting and it's all different and it's all everything's a bit scary. But I've just always been interested in doing things that are a little bit different and a little bit scary. I think, you know...
And did you ever go to prison?
So I didn't. I escaped prison because I'd been enclosed in that space for so many hours. And then I think, again, because it was a later era... they weren't really putting women in prison that much when I was there. That was much earlier because it cost loads of money to put women in prison. I think that was probably my only court. I only ever had one or two court appearances. I mean, because what most... I got arrested all the time. So we were always going in, cutting holes, going into the base and doing actions which ranged from graffitiing to causing a lot of damage to vehicles. To breaking into... Women used to break... So there was a whole American base there, because obviously there was lots of Americans, and there was shops and a church, and, you know, I know a couple of the Christian Green women would break in and go to the church and go to attend a service and then come back out again. But there was lots of just breaking in and doing a bit of damage and then getting chased by the police, the Ministry of Defence police, and often getting arrested, often escaping them. They couldn't always keep up with us. I used to, because I was a sprinter at school, so I kind of prided myself on outrunning them. So I did outrun them and get back out again a few times, as did quite a few women. But yes, I also just got arrested numerous times, well, detained numerous times. And then some of it was about just clogging up their system, but it was tedious rather than scary. So there were lots of porter cabins that were there for the purpose of processing, is what they call it, where, you know, if they caught you in the base doing something, then they would, you know, rather than take you to a police station outside, you would be put in a porter cabin and processed there. So where they'd want to find your name.
Yeah.
So they just like take your details and then...
So do you think they felt that they weren't, it wasn't really working for them if the women just kept on and on and on? And
yeah, for sure.
There was no real consequence.
No, not in those days, no. I mean, you know, a few court appearances, depends on what you were caught for doing. Obviously, if you got caught doing lots of, you know, full-on criminal damage, then you would get done for that.
Yeah.
But most of us in those days escaped that. And we're just basically done for trespass. So trespass was the main thing. And then, of course, what happened years later, because it came out that Michael Heseltine, like, the base was illegal. Michael Heseltine hadn't got the full or the correct planning permission.
Yeah.
And so once that came out, lots of us then got compensation, thanks. So really, because we'd been there for... Because most of us had been arrested for trespass and cautioned and held and some women put in prison and, you know, taken to court for trespass, we could then claim all kinds of damages and costs.
Wow, and so you actually got that compensation?
Oh, yeah.
And was that a decent amount of money? Or?
I can't remember now, but to me as a teenager, for sure, a few hundred quid was a lot of money.
Yeah.
I don't think it was more than a few hundred quid because I hadn't been to prison, but that compensated me. I don't know what women got who'd been to prison.
Right.
I know lots of women had been in prison.
I'm going to just grab a tissue.
Sure, there's one right behind you. There's a whole box, help yourself. No, don't worry. If you want me
I'll
to move, I can move the roses. Do you think they're irritating?
No, I think it's just being outside and all the rest of it. So when you were there, that's long after the decision to make it women only.
Yeah.
What did that space mean to you, that sense of women only space?
Oh my god, it was everything. It was amazing. It was so empowering. And I think for me, you know, growing up in quite a strict Jamaican lock up your daughters kind of household where I didn't have any freedom, which is why that's half of why I ran away from home, is that you know, I wasn't allowed to do anything other than school. You know, I'd had no freedom and I didn't feel very empowered as a woman. I'd, you know, been the victim of various kinds of abuse and did not feel empowered as a woman and was quite scared and had mental health problems. And, you know, to come into a space that supported women with mental health problems and just for being women, and to give me a language and a political understanding and a realisation that this is patriarchy. This isn't just me having a difficult childhood. This is what the world is like.
Systemic,
So I was you know, so it was really liberating. It was like therapy, it was like a political awakening and a political education, and lots of fun to just be around women, these amazing strong women from all over the world who were, you know, we had women from Eritrea, there were women from the sort of the Pacific non-nuclear proliferation kind of campaigns, and to just see how things linked up, that there was something linked up about patriarchy and nuclear arms and war, and to make those connections was really quite amazing, to realise that actually patriarchy is violent and that it's about male violence, and that, you know, what happened to me and what happens to lots of women is actually a thing that's male violence, and that's about patriarchy. It isn't down to an individual not being able to help themselves or being a bit messed up. It's actually part of a structural system.
Yeah.
And I think when you understand that, and then when you meet lots of other women and you're in a space where it's safe, we get heard, we get to talk about it. Because I know a lot of the impetus for Green and Being Women Only was because of all the sexual assaults that still happen in mixed peace camps and mixed spaces. Actually, to be able to be in a women-only space and then have your voice heard as a woman, it is so empowering, because men still take over, men still mansplain, they still dominate, you know, the kind of activist spaces are still quite male-dominated, which is very sad all these years later. Although I think, I don't know, it's all very new, but I went to a planet, an Extinction Rebellion demo last weekend, and that felt refreshingly female run in Brighton anyway. So I think the, you know, women have always been strong and powerful and done stuff,
yeah,
of course, anti-slavery, suffragettes, blah blah blah. I think that a lot of politics and a lot of alternative and activist kind of politics are very dominated by men, and pardon me, Greenham was my first awakening and realisation that women can be strong and powerful and are clever and have the answers, and that actually matriarchal approaches are better than patriarchal approaches, and trying to work things out is better than being adversarial, and using violence creates more violence, and that we can be pacifist in our approaches.
Yeah.
And that was just really empowering. And I think for me also as a mixed race woman, that then kind of, I think the political awakening around feminism also opened my eyes up more towards race politics, which was really important for me. Growing up in, you know, in a mixed race family, being mixed race, and there's just lots of issues there, I think, around having gone to quite white schools, and then Greenham was quite a white area, it was quite white dominated.
Yeah,
I mean, it was mostly white
so
women.
How did that feel and
I think because I'd gone to mostly white school, even though where I grew up in a city, Southampton, was very, very black, but I'd gone to a school 3 miles, 4 miles outside, which was very white. And so I think I'd internalised a lot of racism, and I think I'd internalised a lot of stuff, that the positives of which meant that I was quite comfortable in all white spaces in lots of ways. But also at that point, I didn't have a language for understanding race in anywhere near like I do now, like 30 years later.
Yeah.
And also in the 80s, there wasn't the awareness around race issues that there are now. So it kind of wasn't massively spoken about, and I was too young to really get it. But I know that that era, and then soon after Greenham, and I moved to Bristol, or spent more and more time in Bristol, where there's like really good black politics. That's where I started reading and learning about black politics. But also at Greenham, I came across people like Audre Lorde and Toni Morrison, and sort of lots of black women and black lesbians. So I kind of came across black women's writing and politics at Greenham. So it did link up in that way. But I think it was, you know, uncomfortable without me realising, in the way that I'm often uncomfortable without realising always why. Because, you know, a bit like being in Brighton, I'm often in a very, you know, if I'm in a group, it's probably going to be quite white dominated, and in queer spaces they're often quite white,
so
yeah it almost becomes a bit of the norm.
But you never experienced any racism at Greenham?
Not that I remember, no. No, but I was so young, and I didn't have the politics and the awareness that I have now. So I think if it was now, I'd have a really, really, really different take on it, and I would take issue with a lot of stuff that was going on. Like, the very fact that it was so white dominated is institutionally racist, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I didn't have that awareness at the time.
Do you think it would be now if it happened again, though?
If it happened, would it be so white?
Do you think it would be more diverse?
I think it might be a little more diverse now. And I think there'd be lots of difficult conversations. And I think there'd be lots of white fragility and white tears. Because that's kind of what happens, especially around, you know, yeah, white activist women, white lesbians. I think they're quite fragile because they find it very, very difficult to accept that they've got any privilege.
Yeah.
And I think that people that find it hard to accept privilege, you know,
it's
kind of a bit, you know, and how women are socialized, it's a bit of a go-to to then become really upset and make it all about your being upset and not about racism.
Yeah.
Or the black women.
Yeah.
You know, and in my experience in more recent years where I've been in spaces where it's come up about, you know, so say for example, more recent years where I've been to a black space and a white or a couple of white women have been there because they're interested in knowing or hearing or learning about black issues and we've challenged it. That's what's happened. You get white tears and white fragility rather than them going, oh yeah, okay, sorry, I'll go to a different workshop.
Yeah.
They find it really difficult that they can't go to this one.
Yeah.
So I imagine...
Which is very much the not all men thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the same thing played out.
Yes, yeah. same thing, same difficulties. You know, I'd be really interested to know how it would be if I was this age when I'd gone to Greenham, or if Greenham was now, you know, had the different conversations that we would be having around racism, as in the 80s people didn't really, you know, it was all so new to even have the conversations.
Yeah.
You know, like race legislation had only come in the 70s. It was just... You know, yeah, words that people could say then that aren't acceptable now. It's a very different climate now.
Yes, yeah.
Like, and the racism stuff happens in a very different way.
And just in terms of NVDA, how did that affect you when you were there, and how has it sort of gone on to affect you in your sort of life afterwards?
Again, I think that was something else that was so revolutionary and needed for me. It was so many things. So one, I think it's a very, very useful tactic. I think it's a revolutionary tactic. And I love, who said it? Is it Audre Lorde? The master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house. I'm pretty sure that's Audre Lorde. But I really like that concept and believe in it, that you can't use violence to get rid of violence. It makes no sense logically anyway, but all it does is create continuing spirals of violence. So that concept I found really powerful, and also having been raised in quite a violent upbringing on a personal, again coming back to the personal as political, I think that that was very reassuring and liberating, that again it's about a structural problem, and that male violence and violence in the world is a structural problem, and it's about power, it's about patriarchy, it's the nature of capitalism and various things, colonization, slavery, you know, empire built on violence, and that actually, you know, we need something very, very opposite and alternative to dismantle that. So for me, non-violence is politically really important, and was, and again, it was like, you know, I keep going back to this, but it was my finishing school. It gave me a language and understanding for what's happening in the world and how people interact in that. And so we have this idea that politically we can use non-violent direct action to raise awareness about issues and to protest about issues without buying into the violence that we're trying to protest about.
Yeah, and do you have any particular memories of women really successfully using NVDA at Greenham?
Yeah, I mean, lots of it, all of it.
Yeah,
I mean, the whole
just something
thing
that really made an impression on you.
I think things like the visibility, like making visible what they try to do in secret and creating all of that awareness. And I think the legacy of Greenham, because you can argue the case about whether the sort of governments signing treaties to reduce nuclear arms was much or nothing to do with Greenham women, but you cannot dispute the fact that Greenham women raised visibility and awareness of the fact that there were nuclear bases in this country, and that there are, you know, military establishments doing dodgy things around the country. And so that visibility is NVDA, you know, us sitting on the fence, us building fires, us getting media attention, us spreading awareness, is all successful NVDA.
Mm. Did you have interactions with the media yourself?
Not really that consenting and directly. So when I was saying earlier about lots of people in Southampton realising I was at Greenham in my Jamaican community, was because Southern News had actually spliced a picture of me nodding to a completely different question, but they'd put it on the news whilst actually, I think it was a black woman at Yellowgate, someone at Yellowgate was talking, and this is at the time there was a bit of a schism between Yellowgate and the rest of the camp, so it was all quite interesting that they were interviewing and had the sound of women that they were talking to at Yellowgate with me as a black woman. And I don't know, again, this is 30 years ago, I can't remember what the conversation was, but it was relevant that they'd cut to a black woman nodding to something that someone else was saying about, I think, racism.
Right.
So they had interviewed me because I was nodding, and they'd used just the visual of me nodding, not the conversation that we'd had in the interview.
Right.
So I remember that there was that. But otherwise, I didn't do a lot of media work. Again, I think because I was new and young, it probably went to women who knew much more and could articulate much better than me. I did things like I went to some talks and talked to different women's groups. You know, as a young Greenham woman, but I don't remember doing much media.
Who were there sort of people there that you really loved and cared about, and why did they make an impression on you?
Well, there was Carolyn Garrett, who was my first woman love, who, you know, remained friends with her, and there were lots of women. My best friend, who I'm still in touch with, Jen, we met at Greenham and we're just instantly best friends. She now lives near here in Sussex, so I still see her lots. And her now partner, I was friends with. There were three sisters that used to come to Greenham. And so I'm still in touch with some of those. Women who did my first tattoo, I've seen more recently in London. She's What's still tattooing. Tattoo? I'll show you. Her name's Ellie. She's a great tattoo artist. So this is in the days we all started getting tattoos. Thankfully, when my friends were getting dolphins, I decided to design my own. So I've got more of an abstract sort of a doodle self-portrait women's.
How would you describe that and what it means?
It's kind of like a stylized face, nose, but that, you know, it's got curly, big, wide nostrils, which is sort of relating to my kind of ethnicity, I guess. And then a swirling, labyrinthy type spiral mouth, which could also be, again, this is in my post-Greenham day, so it is also a bit about being a woman. So that could be womb and ovaries. So there's kind of a lot going on.
It also feels like noise coming from the mouth as well. Like, do you know what I mean? Like having your voice heard.
Uh-huh.
As well. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but I'll say it's that now. So Ellie, the tattoo artist, who went out with one of the sisters, the three sisters that I know. And who else? Yeah, so lots of people that were vegan that inspired me, like Atlanta and someone called Iso, who the first person that I fell for. Carolyn and Iso were together for many years, and one by one, a lot of us lived in Cornwall, actually. So when I first moved to Cornwall, I lived sort of next door to Carolyn and Iso. So lots of women I've actually stayed in touch with more or less over the years.
Yeah.
Which is really nice. And then more recently, oh my goodness, I was at a friend's 50th birthday party in London and sat next to this woman who I'd seen at various Black Prides, because she's a white woman who's adopted a couple of black kids, beautiful kids. And then she said, we were chatting, got onto Greenham, and I realised that she was Jo, who used to live at Greengate, who was one of these women that I was so intimidated, I could barely speak to her because she was so beautiful. And you know that thing, especially when you're young, you think everyone else knows it all.
Yeah.
And then I was sat next to her at a party.
Do you remember, and you know those moments when perhaps older people say things to you that really land and you have a sort of epiphany about what they've said politically, and it really means something to you later on reflection. Were there any kind of things like that, or is that a bit too specific a question? I'll just probably imagine there were gems of wisdom. Coming.
There was gems of wisdom the whole time. That's it. It's hard to think of any particular thing. It was just, I think there's the overall thing about the empowerment of it all and the politics of it all and learning so much about everything and connecting everything. That I can't think of particular instances, but there was definitely lots of intergenerational learning both ways. I mean, from a woman called Mel who lived in Newbury, who was a truck driver, who taught us and did loads of car mechanics for us and taught us car mechanics, you know, the practical stuff, the women bringing food, to all the stories and the international connections and the connections between our campaigns and other related campaigns. And yeah, just generally meeting and being inspired by lots of old women, women of all ages.
Yeah. And in terms of art and the way in which the women used like crafting and painting and all kinds of different artistic mediums, did you get much involved with that as a form of protest? Or
not really, living at Greenham, because you're quite limited what you could do actually at Greenham. I mean, the late, you know, oh, for sure that kind of informs some of my art practice when I sort of got into painting and things. But in terms of crafting, I mean, we used to sit and make knottings, you know, like friendship bracelets.
Yeah.
I think we called them knottings and knotties or something in the day. But we used to make lots of those and give them to each other and wear them. That was a bit of a thing.
But did you make banners and things like that?
I personally, yeah, we did. We did make some banners when there was protests and particular protests happening.
Do you remember what was on them?
Not off the top of my head.
What might you put on a banner now?
I mean, Greenham women are everywhere is something that we'd say a lot, and graffiti everywhere. So we would have had those on banners. And what would I put on a banner now?
Yeah, just in terms of the challenges that we're facing politically now.
I guess stop climate change. It'd be about, you know, climate change, I would say. Still a lot of stuff around male violence. Yes, that hasn't changed. We're still experiencing sexual and male violence, I would say. I think that's quite a big issue.
Yeah. And why do you think, I mean, do you, like, one of the reasons we're doing this project is obviously to raise awareness of the political significance and impact of Greenham for younger generations as well, which are largely...
Sorry, do you know what? It's just come to my mind, something that I would want on a banner now would be stuff like, what's on my T-shirt? Quiz Against Borders. So actually, thinking of what's current, is a lot of stuff about migration and borders. Like, I'm a total no borders person and a prison abolitionist. And I think those are actually really key areas of protest now that...
Especially with Brexit, when we're sort of advocating for free trade,
movement
of trade, but not movement of people.
Yeah, and all the racism that's kind of fueling a lot of the Brexit debate, I think, and the anti-immigration idea, and just the fact that people are fleeing wars, and why are there wars, and why is there this struggle for resources, and that's actually, you know, the British Empire has a lot... You know, the past British Empire has a lot to answer for, and actually it needs to share out resources and to... you know, give reparations to people in countries that have been obliterated partly by the previous colonizing policies.
Yeah.
And actually people fleeing the aftermath of that, trying to get help, should be helped.
Yeah.
So I feel quite strongly about that.
Yeah. And in terms of like younger generations today who aren't necessarily as aware of Greenham as they could be. Why do you think that is? Why do you think?
I guess a few things. I mean, it's interesting how... I'm actually happily surprised how much people do know about Greenham when I talk about it. It's very rare that I ever talk about Greenham to younger people who don't know, but that might just be my queer political bubble and my Brighton bubble that I'm, you know, in the London bubble that I live in. Maybe outside those worlds it's less known about, but I think that actually there is a lot of knowledge and awareness of it, that it, you know, people are like, oh wow, you did that, that's amazing, you know.
And what do you feel that the sort of interpretation of Greenham is in our culture, because it has had a few sort of artistic interpretations of it and representations and things like that. How do you feel about it, and do you feel it's accurate? And
I don't know, I can't say that I've seen much or know much to comment on that.
I suppose that's a problem in itself, isn't it?
That yeah. Yes. I mean, going back to the first part of that question is, you know, anything that women do is generally under the radar. So it's not, you know, it's not widely known. It's not like it's taught in school, which is why the archive is so important, is because otherwise we're going to vanish from history. And there's now, you know, I was a teenager in the 80s and I'm now 50. So the women that were in their 20s, 30s, 40s are going to be dying out.
Well, exactly, yeah.
And that's why, you know, it's so timely, isn't it, to be recording this before you lose all the voices and the awareness and the learning.
Yeah. So how would you say, just not just Greenham, but genuinely your other sort of activism across your life? I imagine you seem like you're very involved. How has that sort of affected your personal life, and do your personal and political lives integrate?
Still, always. Yeah. I mean, I'm a queer person of colour, you know, a queer non-binary person of colour.
Yeah.
So everything about me is political. Because of my identities, I can't, not that I want to, because I don't, but I couldn't get away from it even if I wanted to, and I'm vegan, and all of that is very political. Yeah. And I think that a lot of the awareness of those identities and the veganism came about from Greenham days, and having the awareness and the courage and the passion to articulate and feel like what I am is okay and is a political thing.
Yeah.
That comes from Greenham, and the idea of, you know, fuck patriarchy, challenge authority, you know, sort of challenging the status quo, challenging the idea that you have to be one thing and can't be a mixture of things, or that you can't just be who you are.
And has that affected your work or your relationships? Or
I think it has, yes. I mean, you know, I think your multiple identities affects relationships, affects who you are, how you are. It can make life difficult. It limits in some ways what I want to do and where I feel comfortable being. But it also is far more a fantastic thing, in that I love my identities. I love that I'm different. I love the fact that, you know, in lots of ways, I love the fact that I've had mental health problems and I've learnt to manage those problems, and now I use them in my, you know, my yoga teaching work, my mental health work that I do for charities, that advocacy work. You know, it's like all of those things that can be seen as difficult, you can challenge and use.
Do you feel like the time at Greenham helped you find ways to manage mental health?
I wouldn't say it helped me with that, because that was too long ago. I was unaware that I even had mental health problems, or what mental health was at 18.
Yeah.
That wasn't anything I was very aware of. But all the other stuff about feeling empowered and, you know, within your right to be whoever it is you are, I definitely learned. The seeds of that were sown in Greenham, that, in, you know, that's in my DNA.
Yeah.
And I think it's in the DNA that, you know, there's something unique about Greenham and Greenham women, and that's, it's now in our DNA, that experience, that learning, that knowledge, that approach to life.
Yeah. So in terms of legacy, what do you think Greenham's legacy is? Like, we talked a little bit earlier about there's maybe some ambiguity around the impact on Greenham, but in terms of its actual, if you had to sort of,
I'd say the legacy is ongoing. I'd say the legacy is many things. There are the thousands of women who were touched, who either lived there or are raised by women who lived there or visited there or supported it or knew about it. And I think all of those politics that we've talked about that came about from Greenham, that's the legacy. It's like a learning that's been passed on, and that those of us that went there, that are still around, hold, and, you know, we live our lives informed by that.
Do you think that other campaigns use strategies that Greenham used?
I think so, yes.
Have you been on any that have?
So, well, yeah, like the rebellion, the Extinction Rebellion, that's all about NVDA, and I think there's lots of political projects and campaigns, like, you know, the Shut Down Yarl's Wood, the kind of anti-detention centre campaigns, the, you know, I mean, prisoner.
In what way do you feel that yours would?
I think just the idea of using NVDA, just the idea of making visible and making a loud noise about something that governments are trying to hide, that's completely oppressive. I mean, what happens, how people who've been tortured and fled other countries who come here and are then put in prison indefinitely, and they are prisons, those detention centres, how those people who are so traumatised and, like, the self-harm and the suicide attempts and completed suicides horrific in those places, and the sexual assault by the private security companies that are working there is horrific, and that's all been documented. You know, like, but the general public don't seem to be making any noise or concern about it. So making protests and being there, going there, being visible, making a noise, and also waving at the women in the detention centre who can just about stick their hands or wave something out the window. It's so moving. I mean, you can't go there and not cry at one of those protests. I think that kind of thing is a legacy of Greenham, just the idea of making a noise about something that the government are trying to do on the quiet.
Yeah. Great. Did you want to add anything in, like any particular moments that, you know, or memories or anything like that?
I have so many lovely memories, so many fun parties. Just, you know, like we did all the protests and it was all very serious as well, but we had a, you know, that's maybe one of the criticisms from other gates to other gates that we also had lots of fun. And I, you know, I will try and dig it out, but I know I've got a photo of me at 18 with multicoloured dreadlocks and bells in my dreads, sitting on top of Orange Gate, very happy with myself, very pleased with myself. You know, just that I don't know, for me that kind of symbolises the kind of fingers up to the authorities and the establishment that think they can do what they want, and no, they can't, we're going to make a protest.
Yeah.
And that actually we're going to sit on your fence.
Yeah.
We're going to reclaim it. And yeah, just...
Why did you leave Greenham?
I think 2 years was enough for me.
Yeah.
I think that was... I still went back and visited.
Yeah.
But yeah.
What did you go on to do straight afterwards? Because I imagine living inside suddenly was quite challenging.
Yeah, I mean, and it still is. That's like me today. Can we be outside? You know, like I mean, both my parents grew up in the countryside in Jamaica and Dorset, yeah, respectively. I've always loved being outside and in nature, and that's definitely still in there. I loved living outside at Greenham. I loved that I had 2 years of living in the woods and the gorse. So yeah, yeah.
What sort of structure did you live in when you were there?
At first, I had one of these little red getaway tents. I think I then soon progressed onto like a bigger tent.
Yeah.
I lived in the tent. Mostly I lived in tents.
Did you live on your own in the tent?
Yeah, definitely. Because space freak. Especially you're surrounded by people. Yeah, definitely.
Did a lot of women do that then?
I think fair amount. I mean, there were some couples, and sometimes, you know, you'd have a friend stay where you'd sort of share with a friend and it'd be warmer for sure.
Yeah, could you tell us a bit about winter, actually?
Oh my God, it was so cold.
Yeah.
That's why now I hate being cold. Also, I was a lot bigger then. I was, you know, about 3 stone bigger. And I don't know that I could live there at 8.5 stone. Because, you know, I think that layer of fat protected me against some of the cold. And also, you know, when you're a kid, you can do stuff that you wouldn't, you know. I'm such a wuss now. I can't imagine anything worse than living in the cold for 2 winters. There's no way I'd do that. I like my comforts, my flush toilet, my unfrozen toothpaste, my kettle that I can plug in. But you just get used to it all. And, you know, again, it's the...
Was the cold painful?
I don't remember it being so painful. But I just remember, you know, layers and hot water bottles and hiding in the tent a bit and hugging a fire, sitting around the fire, building big fires and having your little breaks away from camp now and then was really important.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing, I could do that.
We had some women tell us that they woke up with, like, snow on their faces and,
So I don't remember that, but it was definitely icicles and frozen water and frozen toothpaste. And, you know, it's hard work. I really, like I said, I could do that at 18. I wouldn't do it now, and not with my knees.
Oh, that's amazing. Was there anything else you wanted to add? I think I've asked a lot of... You've covered such a lot of ground.
Just that it was a beautiful experience. It's like the best days of my life in lots of ways. Like, yes, there were hard bits to it and, you know, I've always struggled with depression and stuff like that, but I know I had so much fun then.
Do you think about it a lot?
I do, yes.
I suppose if you're still in contact with people, so you must talk about it a lot as well.
We do sometimes, and it's funny, it makes me realise, especially this, you know, couple that are just up in the countryside near me, that how little we talk about it sometimes, actually. But it's always there. It's like, it's almost like we grew up together.
It's kind of like going to university, isn't
yes
it?
Yeah, exactly. So you don't always talk about it with your uni friends from 30 years ago, but you do sometimes, and it's a shared, you know, it's a shared history and experience. And what a moment, you know. I just feel so lucky to have been able to be there and share in that learning and that connection and just the fun that we had, the drinking.
Have you read many of the books about Greenham?
I haven't. I've got a few, but I don't know. I never quite get around to reading them.
I suppose you've already lived it, haven't you? Yeah. But it's just so interesting. Actually, really interesting interviewing someone who went later to the camp, because we've interviewed a lot of people who are like sort of setting up and they're very early on.
Right.
And it's really lovely, actually, to see how that early work moved into something so beautiful, and you know,
I'm sure.
I think it was hardcore for some of those women.
I think
the experiences of prison
on me. I think so. I think I was lucky not to go to prison. I was lucky to not be attacked by vigilantes, to not be beaten up by bailiffs and the police. Like, the bailiffs to us,
it's an awful thing to feel that you're lucky to have escaped that, though, isn't it?
So yeah, but I know it was much it was much harsher. It was much harder. I mean, we had to put up with the bailiffs coming every few days and having to move everything, but I think they were very aggressive. They were very aggressive to women earlier on. So I mean, gosh, like, hats off to the women who did that and who set it up.
Yeah.
'Cause that does...
But great that it became this very sort of party, beautiful sort of place, really, where you could, like, university, where you could go and be politicised.
And do actions. Yeah. And I think it's okay that we had fun when we did our actions.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think they had fun too.
For sure. Yes. I hope so. I hope so. I hope they also enjoyed it.
A lot of fun. Yeah. I think it's just interesting. Different people's take on it, and just the difference of the gates as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just such different experiences at different gates.
Yeah.
Oh, you haven't told me much about Blue Gate.
Well, Blue Gate. So there were lots of vegans. I feel like it was more, you know, a slightly younger, slightly more punky, very vegan, lots of Librans. it felt like it was much more me, actually, when I got there. I felt like I'd...
Why did you move?
I wonder how much of it was a class thing, you know, as well. Although I think generally Greenham was pretty middle class. I think I sort of morphed around to Blue Gate because, you know, you always end up visiting, and, you know, I just landed at Orange because of the Southampton connection, and that's where I first was, so that's where I ended up staying, and, you know, was immediately welcomed and stayed there. But then the more I visited Blue Gate, the more I think I felt like I really liked the women there too and wanted to hang out there a bit more. And so I think I just ended up staying there.
Did people mix much at the different gates?
Yes.
Yeah.
Apart from, like I say, there was this bit of a split between Yellow Gate and the rest of the camp.
Do you remember how long in your mind that went on for?
It's really hard to know. I don't know. No, sorry.
No.
Have you had other people talk much about that?
Yeah. Yes, it's definitely come up. I think it was really difficult
at
the time.
Yeah. And again, it's a thing where I wished, you know, I don't wish anything was different, but if I could have gone there with an older person's head, I wish that I could understand it a bit more, what happened and what was going on, and as opposed to just accepting what I was told and it just being a bit of a, oh, this is how it is thing, rather than
something. Well, there's a lot of different perspectives, isn't there, on it as well? Mm. Like, so it's hard to even know a sort of definitive answer, really, when there's so many different views
for
so many people.
And some of it, I mean, you know, I'm all for flat hierarchies and stuff, but I think some of it is in the kind of power vacuum of a non-hierarchical structure, it creates a space for personalities and egos, and, you know, I'm sure on all sides, I'm sure mistakes were on all sides, and it's a shame that there was a bit of a split, and I hope that isn't focused on or take away. I don't think it does take away.
I don't think it does.
I think not now, with the passing of the decades, it doesn't take away.
No, because there's just so much amazing work alongside that from everybody, really. And like, as you said, even while that split was happening, you were having the most, like, amazing political epiphanies.
Yes, and I think really at the end of the day, we just
was set up by those women, you know.
And I think we were all just doing things in our own way, and there was probably a lot of, everyone had a lot of stuff. I think there was a lot of stuff going on for everybody. There was a lot of mental health stuff. I think there was a lot of, you know, learning how to do.
Did you find that a lot of women came to Greenham to escape sexual violence?
Yes, definitely. Well, I mean, I think it's just the nature of it. I wouldn't know how much directly to escape sexual violence, but definitely people came to Greenham who'd run away or were runaways or who were escaping relationships and then either consciously or later on realized that they were into women, or that that they were in unhealthy relationships with men. And there was a lot of people with mental health problems there.
Do you think that's affected maybe your choices in terms of helping in that field, working in that field now?
I think from very young kind of wanted to be a teacher and then a social worker. I think I've always had that in me that I wanted to do, you know, some kind of helping type thing.
Yeah.
But definitely that also informed what I do now. Just like living with people with mental health problems and it being really quite normal. So, you know,
yeah.
There was Metal Mickey Carol who wore spark plugs, who was there because she was in love with the vehicles, not because she believed in beliefs. For sure you've heard of her. So she was quite connected with Southampton Women. Southampton Women did a lot to sort of help her and look after her when Greenham ended, because there's no way she could integrate into so-called normal society. But, you know, and there were other women who were, you know, looking back on it now, had like psychotic symptoms and stuff. And I think people were looked after and accepted for who they were.
Wow.
Quite well. But also, for sure, that was really challenging if there's someone who's a little psychotic. Nothing dangerous happened to my knowledge, but I just mean, you know, how women presented was not always easy or straightforward.
Yeah.
But yeah, that sort of... That kind of, I don't know, how Greenham was full of random women from all over the place with all kinds of stuff going on, presenting in all kinds of ways, that was all normal. So I guess that did inform me working in sort of mental health, and particularly when I teach yoga now on psychiatric wards, on mental health wards, nothing phases me.
Yeah.
You know, everything and anything either is or isn't normal. It's all just human behaviour, and fascinating how people's minds work. You know, politics is fascinating, personalities are fascinating, how we interact, the dynamics, the psychology. It's all just really fascinating to me.
Yeah. Oh, that was brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was really fascinating to hear such a different take on things as well, and a different gauge. Yeah, it was really interesting.